into nothing, making eyes all over the place. Now, anybody who amounts to something always looks the world right in the face.
Time is a silent current. It holds us all. It ushers us through the mystery of how the present becomes the future. It lets the past slip away from us and make sure we weren't looking. The clock of time sometimes is the subtle tick-tock of language itself.
One of the things that I've noticed is my white privilege.
Listen to the voice of Sharon in St. Louis earlier this month in one of our broadcasts from Missouri, answering the question, what has changed for her since the events of Ferguson mysteriously reset her clock, her language, her words?
I don't know that I was ever as cognizant of that as I should have been, but I see it as a prevalent part of my life, why I am, who I am, and what happened to me, because I have had white privilege.
What she said made me feel that quiet, deep river of time, as our humble little radio program keeps asking the same question every way it can. What's happening now? Is something changing? Is our yoke of racial curse and self-imposed violence, the inequalities sculpted in the brilliant logic of educated thinkers with many more college degrees than I have, could all that be crumbling?
It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover that the flag to which you have pledged allegiance along with everybody else has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you.
1965, writer James Baldwin, author of The Fire Next Time, speaking with a seething, quiet, almost orchestral fury, debating in Oxford, England, the proposition, is the American dream at the expense of the American Negro?
I am stating very seriously, and this is not an overstatement, I picked the cotton, and I carried it to market, and I built the railroads under someone else's whip for nothing.
Baldwin, with his proud, hard-won, cold steel erudition, nevertheless confessing his humiliation in the America of Jim Crow. Preoccupied with the nuclear age and the space program, with bigger matters to concern it in 1965 than some social aftermath, the downstream details of slavery. Defending the American dream in this debate, the white American quarterback of team privilege himself, William F. Buckley, who steps up confidently, his smug face says, the dream needs no defending from this mildly interesting upstart.
It is impossible, in my judgment, to deal with the indictment of Mr. Baldwin unless one is prepared to deal with him as a white man. Unless one is prepared to say to him, the fact that your skin is black is utterly irrelevant to the arguments that you raise. The fact you sit here as is your rhetorical device and lay the entire weight of the Negro ordeal on your own shoulders is irrelevant to the argument that we are here to discuss. Mr. Baldwin can write his book, The Fire Next Time, in which he threatened America with the necessity for us to jettison our entire civilization. The only thing that the white man has that the Negro should want, he said, is power.
Fast forward to this week, 2015, in a grand hall at the New York City Public Library. That applause is for someone whose not-so-hard-won erudition still necessitates a confession. Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the book of the moment, Between the World and Me, talking about a fear James Baldwin would no doubt understand.
I think as a young man in Baltimore, I was afraid of everybody else. And then when I left, I realized that they were afraid too. Everybody was scared about what was going to happen to somebody on their block. The best way was to protect yourself, was to project this untrammeled, you know, notion that you just talked about, this almost superhumanity.
Coates was the star attraction at this event. He told the audience of the frustration that led him to write Between the World and Me. It came from loving James Baldwin, but feeling the world around him, particularly whites, were stuck in the world of 1965.
One of my great frustrations even today is how conversations around racism and conversations around our color line, conversations around white supremacy, for whatever reason, tend to begin roughly around the time of the Moynihan Report. It is that everything before nothing, you know, before 1965 really, really matters. That if you want to understand a black community, begin somewhere around the war on poverty and then proceed forward, which is lunacy to me.
He says African Americans experience violence and discrimination and racism, all the familiar words you see and hear in the media, but he uses language to raise the ante and declares them all to be forms and consequences of something he calls plunder.
I started off my career as a poet. So like when I write an article for The Atlantic, it's never enough for me to win the argument logically. You got to feel it. Plunder was just a true word.
And with that word, he comes back to the very argument of James Baldwin. And it's striking to see how little the argument and the circumstances of that argument have changed in 50 years.
And so normally we think about the period of people taking things from black people as ending with slavery. It's even in how we talk about, you know, segregation. You know, we don't think about, like, say, folks being barred from the University of Mississippi as plunder. But it is. It's a public institution. They tax you for that. Right. And you have to obey the law, and you have to hold up your end of the social contract, but you don't get the same protections. And that's plunder. That's a con. I mean, that is exactly what it is. And as far as I'm concerned, it is the dominant thread in explaining the relationship between African Americans and a government and society from 1619 up until today.
And at one point in the evening, in a moment that I found astounding, Ta-Nehisi Coates actually, without realizing it, reaches back to William F. Buckley's facile argument about Baldwin missing what white culture is all about by only focusing on white power. And he answers Buckley's argument by agreeing with him.
People say, you know, we have defined you as part of a black race. It defines how we talk. It defines certain foods, certain musics, a whole, you know, folk ways. White identity is very different. As far as I can tell, you know, white identity is essentially an identity of power. It's just a racial identity.
But did people in this packed audience think anything is changing? Are laws changing? Is the language moving, helping, morphing towards something we might someday call justice?
No, I don't think so. I think, again, that comes so much from how they grew up, what sort of environment they grew up in. You never really see the other side of America.
Things are changing because of this moment, the last couple of years that have preceded it. And particularly I'm talking about the relationship between the African-American community and the police.
I feel more ashamed. I see myself as somebody who has grown up in this country and has imbibed the poison. And my job, for as long as I have left to live, is to fight that and to recognize that and to overcome that as a white person here in America.
We are at least having a conversation, which is different.
I've become less hopeful. It doesn't change anything.
No answers. And why would we make a barometer out of a middle-aged lefty crowd in Manhattan anyway? It's something. And it's something we would probably not have heard with as this diverse and large of an audience even 2 years ago. Ta-Nehisi Coates is part of the change, but also the deeper change on this night, there was no William F. Buckley. No one missed him. And 50 years later, we all understand better where the American dream came from. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.